Yeah.
Okay.
All right.
And then, yeah, do you have the ability to use share screen from where you are?
Yep.
Great.
Can you see the screen?
I can see, yeah. So this
Perfect.
week, yeah, this week is a guest lecture from Gabriel, because the topic is on input attribution, where Gabriel is one of the world's experts on how to do this with large models, with LLMs and so on. And so since he's here this semester, I asked him to give the lecture on the topic here today. And it's a little too bad that it's all remote, because as you know, we try to make sure that everybody gets a chance to ask their questions and interact. So I want you to not do the normal Zoom thing and zone out during the lecture. Maybe Gabriel can make sure that there's times in the talk to get to get feedback or questions from people answered. Okay. Yeah, Jasmine, superstar, right? Yes, Jasmine, this is Gabriel from
You're too
the
kind. You're too kind.
reading. Excellent.
So thanks again for having me, David. It's really great. So today's presentation that I prepared is called Attribution, Tracing Influence to Inputs and Model Components. And I will try to walk you through some of the most recent some background first, and then some of the most recent let's say interesting stuff that is going on in this area of interpretability. So the first thing is that the way that we can conceptualize attribution is by looking at what the models are using to do predictions, right? So in here I argue that there are basically two pathways to prediction. The first one is the inputs. So the models receive, as you know, in context information. And these methods that we use to trace importance back to the inputs are what we normally refer to input or feature attribution. So this is what we call also this in-context learning, right, in language models. And the other dimension that is complementary is whatever the models learn from training, right? So in this case, we have the learned weights, and we can still do some attribution. It's a bit related to causal mediation that you saw from the previous lecture. So you're gonna see here too, we have a way to do basically component attribution. So understanding which components are responsible for a specific prediction. And the plus one is there is a second order effect, of course. So whatever learned weights the model has are derived from training data, right? So a big mission in attribution would also be to ideally trace back whatever importance from the prediction to back to the training data, right? So there are some methods that are responsible for that. I'm not really covering that part today. But just for your knowledge, these methods are kind of very similar to the others that we're going to discuss, and these are called training data attribution or simply data attribution. So the overall attributional interpretability is asking which elements motivate model predictions, right? That's the big question. So this is kind of a formalized way to think about input attribution. So if you have a trained model and an input that the model receives, the input attribution method is just a map that, given an input, in this case of dimension D, it will produce a set of scores, alpha 1 to alpha D, that are telling you how relevant is the ith dimension of this input for the prediction. So, what counts as relevance here is quite vague, and it's left vague on purpose in a sense because it's very hard to formalize what does it mean for something to be salient or important towards prediction, right? So we're gonna maybe discuss this a bit more in the next few slides, but just for you to know, like saliency is a bit of a fuzzy concept overall. So to quantify importance, If we had simple linear models, right, like linear regression models, this would be a very trivial things to do. Like we could just look at the coefficients that are learned. So whatever the weights here that would be matched to the matrix of the inputs would be our importance scores, right? However, for deeper models, this is not straightforward, and the reason for that is that is the presence of nonlinearities, right? So nonlinearities mess up this kind of contributions of different inputs, and especially when they are chained, like in a deep neural network, the whole influence becomes very messy. So generally, the way that we go about estimating this importance is through some approximations, for example, approximating some specific operations linearly, or perturbations. So trying to kind of like try to estimate how important something is by just ablating it or modifying it slightly. So let's have a look at the most basic setup for attribution, which is occlusion. So in the case of occlusion, let's say that we have our language model here. Let's say this is like our GPT or our Llama, and we have an input that is a simple string, right? For example, welcome back, ladies, and that, as you know, gets tokenized and embedded before being fed through the model. So you see, this is our of dimension d, which is the dimension of the embedding, time s, the dimension of the sequence. And the output of the model is this distribution of probabilities over the vocabulary. So in this case, we find that the model is predicting gentlemen as the most likely next token. So the occlusion case is very simply, let's ablate a single token, for example, ladies. So here we're going to have a different embedding for the ablated token, and let's get an output for the perturbed input, right? So in this case, the probabilities will change. And an idea would be, okay, the way that we associate an importance to the token ladies is by looking at the top prediction and looking at how big of a drop this is, right? In this case, the drop is huge, so it means that ladies is probably very important towards that. Probably you can see already that this is overall a bit problematic as a procedure. I'm curious if someone already has a hint of like what could be the problems in doing that, or
So, can I ask? Because I'm not the expert here, is that right? That's, so when you include it, what do you put there?
Yeah, that's one of the problems, exactly. So there is no good answer to that, actually. This I mentioned in the next slide, but one of the issues with perturbation and in general with this kind of like occlusion, which is related to one of the questions that we received also for integrated gradient, what would be a good baseline for language, right? The problem is that perturbations, let me go to, yeah, can produce OOD behaviors, and this would result in unfaithful explanation in the case in which you're replacing that with something that is not realistic, right? So for example, if we have let's say for encoder language models like BERT, we have this kind of mask tokens, right? Which are kind of interesting in this setting because we could just replace things by masks, and the model is trained with masks, right? So it's able to handle that. But for GPTs, we don't have such things, right? The model is just predicting left to right, so it doesn't need masking. Yeah, so the coder LLMs don't, right? And one common approach is to sample replacements randomly and aggregate over multiple replacements, right? But you can imagine that this scales very poorly, right? So if I have to do 100 replacements with random tokens and just measure how big of an impact is on average, this becomes very expensive. I just attributed a single token in this case, right? So imagine if I was to attribute the full sentence then, right? So this is very expensive and it scales poorly to long inputs. So an alternative, a natural alternative in neural networks is to use gradients as some sort of attribution. So the models, as you all know, are trained with gradient descent. So this gradient information is naturally employed during training. And we can repurpose that to try to get a sense of the importance of components at inference time. So let's see an example. Here again, we have exactly our same setup as before. We get the prediction gentleman. But then the way that we will go about that is we pick a specific target in a target function, let's say. In this case, the target could be the probability of the topmost likely token, like gentleman. And we can take the gradient with respect to that back to the input embeddings of the model. So note that here, these gradients normally are taken with respect to a loss, right? So the gradient with respect to a loss tells you how do I minimize this loss? So which weights should I change to minimize this loss? In this case, instead, the gradient with respect to probabilities is telling us, in a sense, how sensitive is this final output of the model, so the final probability for gentlemen, to little perturbations of, in this case, if we focus on input embeddings, of these embeddings, right? So the final outcome of this procedure is gradient vectors that have the same exact dimension as the input embeddings, and that basically express each dimension of the input embedding. How important is that towards the prediction of the final output? So normally this is not very useful, right? One score per dimension is not very useful. So what we do is normally to aggregate those at the token level to get a single score per word. So in this case, we could find, for example, that the gradients for ladies and are very high. And if we aggregate these, for example, by taking the vector norm of each one of these gradient vectors, we would get a high attribution score for ladies and, which is intuitive, right? If we perturb ladies and, the model probably wouldn't predict gentlemen. So this relies on this kind of approximation. Is everything clear for the gradient attribution part? Yeah.
You
I
guys are
think.
so, you guys are all camera off. Oh, I'm camera off too. Look,
Yeah,
I'm camera
exactly.
off, so it's like
I'm kind of like
impossible for Gabriel to tell what's going on. Yeah.
I don't know.
So you just take a vector size. Is that typically really what people do, or do they do other things other than?
This is another thing that there is no consensus. So there's plenty of ways that people try to do this kind of aggregation. So, for example, the L2 norm is probably the most natural way to do this, but other people took the sum of the gradients, or the L1 norm is like these are all commonly used, and there's no like one size fit all kind of.
Okay. Wait, I had
So,
a
yeah. Sorry. Yeah.
So what's the general sample size people use? I'm assuming they don't compute the gradient on one example and show this graph, right? So what is the general sample size that people use?
I mean, the idea here is that the gradient attribution is really local, right? So meaning for a given example, you're going to get your scores out in this case, right? If you want to draw some hypothesis from the kind of information that you get out of this, definitely you want to have some data set and to be able to tag, the kind of expected behaviors that you would like to see and see whether the gradient attribution retrieves something that matches your intuition, right? So I agree with you that on a single example, this doesn't tell you much.
But that's actually one of the nice things. So isn't what do you think that's true, right? That there's one of the nice things about input attribution is that it is about, you can analyze single examples. It's trying to get you an answer about single examples, right?
Exactly. So it's really a local thing, right? It doesn't give you any intuition about the behavior of the model globally, but rather on that specific example. If you want to get this global intuition about model behavior, you probably have to repeat the thing on a data set, right? And see whether the trend that you observe on that example holds in general.
Okay, thanks.
So this all relates to the fact that the devil is in the details for attribution methods, and we got some questions here. So what
Oh
happens
yeah,
in this?
we'll have them ask the questions. Courtney had a question. Armita had a question. What were your questions?
We had this problem in our like my research project that we wanted to build adversarial input examples, and many of them are gradient based. And our input, our data was like discrete, so changing them in a way that like increases the gradient sometimes wasn't so meaningful because we had few perturbation options. But in this context, I was wondering if the same issue exists.
In a sense, as you saw in the example before, the way that we move from like the continuous space that the model operates on to the discrete space of, for example, the vocabulary of the model is by just aggregating, right? Whatever we get in the continuous space at the token level. I agree that in your case of like trying to optimize these embeddings, maybe like in a way that they still map onto words, probably you would have to have like some sort of projection to the nearest neighbor procedure, right? That it can be quite noisy in the case of
Is that
this.
what you did in your experiment, Armita? Did you do a nearest neighbor thing?
No, we didn't do gradient based.
Oh, you
Oh,
moved to something different. Okay, cool.
yeah.
Is Courtney here? Does Courtney have a question?
Yeah, hi. My question is about whether or not you can tell when like a specific token, or in the Mirage example, a specific document is actually negatively contributing to a prediction, or like taking away from, moving away from the correct answer, or if the attributions are only positive.
So in the gradient case, definitely you can do that. Also in the occlusion case, so overall, let's say in the occlusion case, you would have the simple setup where this estimated importance could either increase or decrease the probability. So you could see this as a positive or negative contribution. While in the gradient case, gradients will be signed in these vectors. So depending on the kind of attribution that you do. And now I'm kind of getting a bit ahead on what I'm saying here. Depending on the aggregation, this information might get lost. For example, if you take just the L2 norm of the vector, then you're effectively just getting a positive value that is overall how much it contributes, abstracting away positive and negative contribution. But if you sum, for example, you would get something that can also be negative, right? If all the dimensions are kind of negative.
So are there other ways of aggregating that you wouldn't lose it?
I would say probably the sum is the most common here. You could also get like something like, just this kind of heuristic, I guess, like the maximal dimension within the embedding. If it's a negative dimension, then you would say that it's a negative contribution.
Oh,
There has been,
there was something we saw in the in Bean Kim's TCAV paper. Where once she had a gradient, she dot producted it with some particular vector of interest, right? You might dot product it with a class or dot product it with like a token or something like that.
That's true, that's true.
Did people ever do that or?
Maybe so. I don't have a slide for that, but I think it's interesting to relate it to the dot product, right? It's interesting to think of when we talk about gradient attribution, to think of the gradient vectors per se versus the gradient times whatever input they would be applied to, right? So these are two common attribution methods, like just gradient, raw gradient, and gradient times input. And like the gradient per se tells you the sensitivity kinda of the inputs to the like of the prediction to the inputs. But the moment you multiply them, you actually get some sort of scaling by actually considering what these gradients would be applied to, right? You might have very high gradients just because the dimension that they would be applied to is very small, right? So definitely this relates to what you're saying, David. I think depending on what you're looking for, it might make sense to consider gradients in relation to their inputs and not just by themselves, right?
Yeah, I think so. And I think that might give you a sign also. So you could have a positive one or a negative one in that case.
Exactly.
Think it's a pretty interesting question from Courtney. Okay, let's keep on going. I don't want to slow you down too much.
No worries, no worries. So I just want to highlight here this like plenty of people work on this and there's no established norms basically. So every new paper that does attribution does it in a different way. And there's no consensus of like, oh, this always works the best, So I think there's a lot to be explored still in this area. So one of the readings that you had was integrated gradients, and I took this image, which was quite nice, which was from this blog post that says integrated gradients is a decent attribution method, which I found funny. The intuition is what you see here in the image is you have a starting point here. You have an endpoint, which is going to be your baseline, and effectively you're taking steps, right? Like ideally, this would be an integral, but actually you're probably approximating this by taking steps alongside this straight line. So this is the activation space, and then here you would have two input features. In reality, we have many more, and what you're doing is just by adding up the contributions of each one of the two features, right? So this is a nice way of visualizing what's happening here. So integrated gradient is quite robust because of this property of like considering contributions alongside this path. In practice, though, to get a good approximation, probably it's quite expensive to run, meaning that you will need many approximation step alongside this line. And as many of you noted, the lack of a good baseline is often a problem, actually. So especially in NLP, people have tried the zero vector, which again doesn't mean anything in the NLP world. They tried to use the kind of like out of vocabulary token or the mask token. I think overall the best idea is really to do random sampling and just averaging out, but this again is extremely expensive, so no consensus there. So there were some interesting variants that were proposed specific to NLP. I have an image here. So the idea here was instead of going for a straight path, let's instead do this kind of clumping to the nearest neighbor, kind of like we were saying before, and let's find the path that passes through existing tokens in the model vocabulary. So let's take the integral with respect to this path. It kind of works, but it's not that much better. So again, there's no like one size fit all for this kind of method. And I also wanted to highlight the smooth grad, which is another different approach, which is just introducing noise to the gradient estimation with just some Gaussian, for example, noise. This also improves robustness. So this points to the fact that actually what matters is the robustness in this kind of evaluations, right? Because gradients are noisy overall. So there were several questions regarding the implementation invariance properties here, whether they always hold, whether they're good, and whether the axioms matter in practice. I think overall, my perspective is that they don't really matter in the sense that I feel like this is really, best case scenario. Although integrated gradients is not really the best nor the most efficient method out there. So probably, especially this implementation invariance is kind of like a moonshot kind of goal of like having two models that are exactly identical, except for, the implementation, but they behave exactly identically. I think this is not very realistic. Yeah, so there was someone that was mentioning, I don't remember if it was Claire maybe, that was mentioning in their example about the, like, what if we have this classification that is based on the background versus looking at the subject in the photo, and then the two behaviors are the same but for different reasons, right? But then the maybe you can correct me if if I said it wrong.
No, that's right.
Right. Yeah, so my take on that is that if indeed this was the case, like implementation invariance would apply to all sort of examples, right? So you should be able to craft an example if the heuristics are different, such that the two networks would have different behaviors. And if the two networks have different behaviors, then implementation invariance doesn't apply, right? So then yeah, I feel like again, what you're pointing at is the fact that for a given set of examples, this might be the case that the two methods, like the two networks, are behaving in the same way. But in practice, this is rarely the case. If they have different heuristic, you should be able to find examples that lead them to behave differently, right? I don't know if you agree with that. All right. So one thing that I wanted to mention is that my opinion on the most promising approaches that are currently used in this space are methods that are basically trying to tweak this kind of gradient propagation without making it too inefficient. So they don't take this kind of approach of like taking steps or multiple prediction steps, but they are just crafting some either custom propagation rule, like in the case of layer-wise relevance propagation, or accounting for transformer quirks. So this gym method, for example, is something that was recently proposed, and one of the things that they were proposing is can we compensate for this kind of behavior where if you remove something in from the input, then the softmax would reallocate the importance, and then this will lead to different behavior, right? So I think these are very interesting, especially because their cost in the end is the same as regular gradient-based attribution, so much more efficient than integrated gradients, so probably can scale to these kind of applications where we use language models, right? All right. So one area that has been explored to some degree, but yeah, with mixed success, is instead the idea of like just looking at model internals. So for now, we always relied on prediction, right? Either we take the gradient with respect to the prediction, or we look at the difference in prediction when I don't know, ablating, occluding components. But here maybe we can just look at some properties within the network to try to understand how the model is allocating importance to different components in the input. For example, initially people were very keen on doing that with attention weights, right? And this has been kind of like controversial. So you in this mixed success links, you find two papers that are titled "Attention is not explanation," and "Attention is not not explanation." So people debated that quite a lot. I think there are some promising works here. So as I said, initial work were looking at attention weights in a vacuum, which was quite misleading. Then there has been some work in that direction that thought the reason why this is misleading is that we're not considering the actual vector, so the value vectors that these weights are multiplied by. So why don't we instead look at the vectors, so the magnitude of the resulting vectors, rather than looking at the attention weight? So in this example here, you can see the second attention weight is quite large. So you would say, oh, this word is very important, but actually the vector is very small, and maybe this is just a compensatory behavior, right? To get a final vector that is not too small. And the final perspective here was, can we relate these three vectors here to the final outcome of the attention operation and see which one of these is closer to that? If this green vector, for example, is closer to the final outcome of the attention operation, then it might be that is the most influential towards that computation, right? Meaning it's the most aligned with whatever the attention is doing to the vectors in the input. So these are some pointers for you if you're interested in digging deeper. The cool part about these approaches is that it's entirely forward-based, so there's no back propagation, super efficient at inference time, can scale very well with like long context, you know, big models. So definitely that's the big appeal of these kind of methods. All right. So I wanted to give you an overview also of the InSync
So
toolkit that
actually,
is,
can I
yeah,
pause you
sorry.
for a moment? But Gabriel,
Sure.
so you sort of described two, or maybe three different classes of methods now. So you've described
Right.
occlusion, you've described these kind of interesting gradient-based methods, and then these, I guess this, so you maybe this kind of attention-based methods, or are there things other than you say internal space, but maybe the mainly attention-based methods. And so like, okay. So we got all these students here trying to do their projects, and they're probably going to try some input attribution at some point. What's your opinion? Do you, like w like would you advise people to do one of these or the others? One of them, the things that people believe more. Or, yeah, what I just want to get a sense for your own opinion.
Yeah, so I think my perspective is again, these gradient-based ones, these specific variants seem to be the most faithful at the moment, and they are kind of actionable if you're working with models that are not extremely large. So probably if I had to go for something, I would go for one of these two methods that I'm linking down here. They both have quite nice implementations available, so that's also a big plus, right? Kind of like you can just plug and play with existing models. So that would be my guess. If I really found out that this wasn't scalable enough for the use case that I'm working on for whatever reason, because it's too long of a context, too big of a model, I guess my second choice would be some of these for information flow routes, for example, which is a forward-only method, probably would be my go-to.
Nice,
I guess
thanks.
that's my opinion. Yeah.
Cool.
One question.
Yeah. Yeah. Sorry.
Sorry, yeah. So the gradient-based approaches, wave, so based on your experience, how much does it scale for long context? Let's say if I want to analyze a chain of thought and want to, let's say, understand which are the important input tokens or important input sentences, would the integrated gradient methods work?
The only downside with gradients is that sometimes we find some sort of spread out of probabilities. So it's unlikely that all the tokens will receive exactly zero importance, right? Even if we were to ablate them, probably the output would be irrelevant for many of them, like I don't know, function words, you know, this kind of unrelated stuff. So that's a more of a property of the gradient that if the context is very large, the importance will tend to be very spread out. I think this is something that can maybe be mitigated by using different in the future, meaning like when designing model architectures, I think in general, you know, going towards more sparse activation functions, for example, sparse max instead of soft max, that would promote this kind of sparsity at the output level. And potentially, this could also reflect into a sparsity in the input when taking gradients with respect to that. So I agree with gradients. That's a potential failure case. I think even if spread out, the magnitudes will still be informative, though. I have an example later on retrieval augmented generation. You can see that even for longer context, this is somewhat informative. Yeah.
Okay, cool. Thanks.
All right. So I just wanted to show you this toolkit that we built that is exactly for using attribution methods, mostly gradient-based on language models. So the idea here is that you have your Hugging Face model, let's say a GPT-like model that receives a prompt, and the model will do autoregressive generation, predicting one word at a time. For example, to innovate, one should think outside the box. And what the toolkit allows you to do is simply at every generation step, we extract the attribution scores for the given prefix, and we can extract also quantities of interest, for example, the probability of the output, the entropy of the output, which are also what we're taking the gradient with respect to, right? So the final outcome of all this would be something that resembles this table. So the way that you read this is that the columns are the tokens that were generated, and on the rows is the prompt at every generation step. So you see this triangular pattern here is because every new token gets added as an element in the prompt at every generation step. So it has an influence on the next steps of prediction. And you also have, for example, some information of interest. Like here, I'm also extracting the probability of the predicted token at every step, kind of like the final prediction probability. So you can see in this example that the moment that the model starts predicting think outside the box, the model is mostly relying on innovate, which is the keyword to predict the multi-word expression. But the moment it starts producing the sequence, its kind of saliency shifts towards the previous tokens in the sequence, which kind of reflects the model knows where it's going and is just looking at the prefix to finish the expression, right? This is also reflected by the probability that starts kind of 50%, but then it becomes increasingly closer to 100%. So yeah, here you have easy access to like a dozen attribution methods, including attention weights, gradient base, internals base, specifically for generative LMs. So like both encoder-decoder or decoder-only language models. And in the paper that we had related to this toolkit, we did a couple case studies. The first was to study gender bias in machine translation. So we were highlighting that pronouns have a big role when the model decides to use, sorry, that professions, stereotypical professions have a big role when the model decides to translate as he or she in a from a language that doesn't have the distinction. And then we also try to approximate patching, so I have a slide on that later. So this is a simple example of using the library. So here we load a model with integrated gradients, which is the method that you saw. And we do this model.attribute, which is kind of like the generate function in Hugging Face. Just on top of that, we also extract whatever we're doing, right? So here it's we prompt the model with does 3 + 3 = 6? And the output that gets generated can then be visualized with show. And it looks like this. So the model predicts yes, end of sequence. And here we have attribution scores for the prompt plus the yes in the case of the end of sequence, right? So do you notice something kind of weird here? Like, is this kind of attribution pattern what you would expect for this kind of task?
So I'm gonna just talk out loud here because I'm really being slow here. But let's see. So does 3 + 3 = 6? And I would expect. Oh, I see. So then it's got to decide. So it's deciding whether this is true or not. And I would expect that the things that it would have to look at to decide whether it's true is it needs to look at the answer.
Right.
Like
It
the
needs to
and it
look at
has
the
it has to and it
equation
has to look at
also,
the
right?
question. It has to look at the question and answer, right? So like if you right, so like if it would say like 3 + 4 = 6, right, that would be a different answer. So like the 3 and the 6 seem like they'd probably be the most important things. Maybe the plus.
That's right. That's
But it's
right.
not. It's like they're the least important parts of the sentence.
Indeed, indeed. So like my hypothesis by looking at this example was, can it be that this model is just so strongly trying to figure out the output desired format, like the fact that this is a yes/no question rather than a mathematical come up with your answer question, that the fact of these function words receiving high importance is just because these are what are driving the final format, right? These are what produces the yes rather than the equation itself, right? But
Oh,
then
right. Because you're saying there's 50,000 other words that it could say here. It could say pumpkin or whatever, right? And
well, it could be that
uh-huh.
this model is trained to do math, right? And
Yeah.
then it's usually prompted to produce an answer given a mathematical expression. But in this case, the answer is not a number, right? So then it has to rely pretty heavily on function words that define the kind of expected format, which is yes, no, right?
I see, I see. I see.
So this can lead us to formulate some hypothesis, right? Like the equation is not getting much importance. So can it be that the model is actually getting it right for the wrong reason, right? Maybe it's not actually caring much about the equation and it's just betting 50-50 yes or no, right? And this can be tested. And indeed, we find that this is a pretty old model, but it's saying yes also for does 3 plus 3 equals 7, right? So in this case, I just gave you an example of like we started from some attribution to formulate hypotheses that then we test behaviorally, right? So the thing that I want to emphasize here is the attribution itself didn't give us any causal confirmation that what we were trying to do was like that the model wasn't actually doing the expression, but kind of highlighted that maybe the importance was a bit off for this kind of problem, right? So this could be valuable for this kind of hypothesis generation. Sorry, I'm seeing that
Oh yeah, this.
Jasmine brought some messages. I can, we have some examples later. I can try to discuss more about those in the next few slides. So there were some questions about faithfulness. I don't know if people are here. Maybe they want to ask them themselves.
Lose, yes, go ahead. Or Jasmine, either one.
Oh, I guess like for me, I was wondering like when like an explanation is like informative enough. Like for instance, like if someone asked me like why did you eat an egg this morning? Like I could say like because I was hungry, but I could also say something like okay, like when I was born, like my mom fed me, you know what I mean? Like it could start from 20 something years ago. Like how do you know like when you have enough information and you're like that's like a reasonable explanation?
Right. Yeah, I think my answer to that is whenever it's sufficient to predict behavior in the current use case, right? Like at a satisfactory level, I think that's probably the way that we tend to operationalize faithfulness overall. So so I would say that's the best way to understand, you know, like if our explanation allows us to some degree to understand, you know, what the model is doing there, and if we can act upon it, then probably our explanation is faithful with respect to how the model is doing things internally, right? And maybe, you know, if it's a high-risk domain, probably I wouldn't trust even very faithful explanation in the medical domain because the stakes are very high, right? So then, you really need like to weight your expectations based on the kind of application, I guess. So I like two dimensions in faithfulness. So this is a paper actually from Northeastern from Barron Group. So they were working on faithfulness very early in interpretability, and one way that they were defining faithfulness was two complementary perspectives. So if we want actionable results, is if these tokens are found to be important. One idea is if we drop these tokens, then we expect a big impact on the results, right? So this is what they call comprehensiveness. It's kind of like ablation, right? A kind of like occlusion. We occlude, we cause a big impact. The other perspective is sufficiency. So here we're saying if we only have these tokens and we remove all the rest, do the result remain kind of consistent, right? So yeah, this is just a visualization. If we find most amount of leaves as the important part, we would have comprehensiveness is like if we drop that, the probability drops. If we only keep that, the probability kind of stays the same. This is sufficiency. So the loose question about, I think, I don't know if loose is here. Maybe not. Right? I can summarize it. So the question was, if the models are able to explain themselves, like to, for example, for Mirage, it was if the models can cite alongside giving an answer, why do we even need a faithful method that looks at the internals, right? If the model can already do that. And our point with that paper was actually that the fact that models are so capable as to being kind of precise is kind of a recent thing. And before, we were just relying on superficial matching. So the citation was done mostly by saying, oh, here is the answer. Here is the three documents that the model received. Let's just embed those and look at the similarity between those and find whatever is the most similar, right? So I think the answer to this question is, I think there is an interesting perspective where we try to make models more aware of their inner workings. And in that direction, potentially we wouldn't need so much of like digging deep into the model if the model indeed can kind of self-predict well enough, right? I think we're still kind of far from this perspective though. So I think probably we do need this kind of method still for the foreseeable future. And the complementary perspective to faithfulness is plausibility. So the plausibility dimension is user-centric instead of being model-centric. And it's asking, can these explanations be understood by whatever users of the system are looking at the thing? So one big problem is that you don't have guarantees that faithfulness and plausibility go hand in hand, right? So ideally, the more faithful you are to the model, the more understandable you are for humans, but potentially there could be a disconnect there, right? So sometimes this has also been highlighted as a trade-off. So the more you make explanation plausible, the more you're abstracting away the inner complexity of the model, and this produces this kind of mismatch that maybe you're kind of like diluting too much the complexity for users. So again, this is application dependent. And one interesting idea that I like in this domain is counterfactual simulation. So the kind of setting would be if you have an example and you can get attribution out of this, the idea would be to, given the attribution, can I simulate a counterfactual that would produce a different behavior, right? Like in the other case that we saw just before, can I simulate the fact that if I change the 6 into a 7, the model still predicts yes, right? And then what you would do is to compare, the expected result with the actual behavior in this case. So this is a good way to understand whether what you're looking at is kind of plausible or not, right? All right. Now
Would you flip
talking.
back to what was the paper that you cited for that one? Sorry, connecting
Oh yeah,
attribution.
it's a paper from some years ago from Greg Durrett, from the group of Greg Durrett about like doing this kind of counterfactual for evaluating explanations.
And so was that paper about like sort of human evaluations? What did Durrett do?
Yeah, they were trying to do similar stuff. Like this figure is taken from there. So this is their setup actually. Yeah, they were doing it mostly for classifiers though, NLP classifiers. So I do think that it's a bit more challenging to do that in the generation setting. That's a bit related to what we did for the P-core method actually.
Okay, cool.
So, like the contrastive attribution setup, I think it's very compelling for language. And I just want you to focus for now on the example that I have on the left. So, if you have this input, right, can you stop the dog from? and the model predicts barking. If we do gradient-based attributions, so this is just simple gradients taken with respect to the inputs, and we do the aggregation as I showed before, you would get some scores that look like this. So red is positive and blue is negative in this setting. So do you think this is intuitive, what you're seeing here? Like these attribution scores, do they make sense to you given this prompt? Maybe not.
So there's things that are very positive and things are very negative. And does white mean like close to zero?
Yeah. Yeah. So the highest tier is from, right? From is very, very positively influencing barking.
Right. And V is very negatively influencing barking.
Yeah.
But the word that has the least effect is dog.
Yeah.
Which makes you smile. It seems like it's very counterintuitive. Seems like look at Nikhil's laughing at this.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean that's weird, right? That's exactly the opposite of what we would expect, right? And I think one of the reason for that is that as humans, we tend to reason counterfactually, right? So when I'm asking you, what would come after that? Like, can you stop the dog from barking, right? If you had to explain barking, you have the tendency to reason semantically about barking, right? So like barking dog are related words, so dog should receive a big importance, right? But exactly as Jasmine is saying in the chat, eating could be an alternative word, right? So naturally, in a sense, we're contrasting in our head barking with some other plausible alternative that doesn't involve dogs, right? Well, in practice, what attribution here is doing is just detecting relevance, right? And I could argue with you that the from here is super important to predicting barking because it's the next previous word, and it's exactly defining that the verb should be in that form, right? Without from, we wouldn't have a present continuous verb there, right? So then it's essential, right? So then how do we actually bring this closer to human intuition? So the idea that they had in this paper that I'm citing here from Graham Newbig and Kaiyo Yin is to have a contrastive attribution. And the way that you would do this is by contrasting two words. So the idea is very simple. Instead of taking the gradient with respect to a single probability, we can take it with respect to a difference in probabilities. Here, probability of barking versus probability of crying, for example. And then the gradient that we get with respect to the input looks a lot more reasonable, if you ask me. So dog now finally has a meaning, and from is doesn't matter much because it would be a good choice for both verbs, right? So in their work, what they were showing is that by disentangling this kind of semantic factors from syntactic factors, you can improve simulatability, which is a bit like what we were seeing before in plausibility. So the ability of a human to actually predict whether the prediction would change by changing a specific word, right? So yeah, one thing that I want to stress here on the right is that the attribution function, like the attributed function, in this case, the difference in probability, is fundamental to the way that you interpret what you're getting out, right? So in this case, we saw by taking this difference, you can interpret it as a why this rather than something else, right? But here I make an even more abstract example. I could attribute the entropy of the final distribution over the vocabulary, and this could maybe tell me what in the input is driving the uncertainty in the model, right? Or the certainty in the model. So in principle, like the possibilities are endless, you know, you could attribute any kind of function of your prediction, and the attribution scores would tell you different things depending on what you're looking at, right? So I think here again, there's a lot of untested ground in this area. So people are just kind of starting out in digging into potential variants of that. Yeah, and I
So it
mentioned
looks like
before
you
the
have
co
a question
sorry.
from Arnav online from the chat.
Oh, sorry. Maybe these attribution methods are just not good enough for modeling 2D order effects. Yeah, that's a good point. I have a slide later about actually modeling interactions of features. So there are some methods that are specifically meant for that, since many people ask in the class. But yeah, they're very expensive. So definitely that's also another problem why they haven't seen much usage.
So the Graham-Newbig method here, this cool contrastive method, it's like, but this is pretty simple. This is pretty lightweight. It's like a pretty cheap gradient to compute. That's neat. It also seems like, well, like you here they're applying it to a gradient method. Well, it seems like you might be able to do this for some of the other methods you talked about, like the occlusion,
Yeah,
looking at
sure.
attention, looking at LRP, all this stuff. Like you might be able to drop in.
I think they were trying in their original paper also occlusion, like this kind of setup for occlusion. I have personally already implemented the LRP with the contrastive attribution. So this works. It's
Oh,
tested.
you did
It,
it. Oh,
yeah,
you
yeah,
just. Oh, so you like it. I see
yeah.
the smile here. So
Yeah,
you think
yeah,
this would
yeah.
be a good way to
I'm a
go.
big fan of this idea. For
I see.
NLP, I think it's very valuable because the output space is so large, right? You have
Right.
so many tokens that it just makes sense to pin down
Nice.
exactly what you want to compare. Yeah.
Nice. That's great. Thanks. This is really helpful.
Great. I just wanted to mention, so for component attribution, I think last lecture or two lectures ago, you saw with David the causal mediation, right? So this might be familiar to you, this kind of setup. Eiffel Tower is located in Paris, right? So when we introduced the InSeek library, we asked, but can we use contrastive attribution for approximating causal mediation, right? Can we use this contrastive gradient attribution to get saliency, not for the input tokens like we saw just now, but for all intermediate steps, right? And kind of see how much does it agree with causal mediation. And our results was that, of course, this is much coarser and not as sharp as causal mediation, but we did also see this kind of early sight that they were highlighting on the last subject token. So to some degree, let's say our method was associating much more importance to the last token, but it still found some structure that using causal mediation would have required a lot of ablations, right? And the cool part here is that this is very efficient, right? We do a single forward pass and we do one backward pass in which we get saliency values for all the nodes here in the graph. And that's it. Instead of doing sequence length, time, number of layers, forward passes to estimate causal mediation. So actually, there is one very popular attribution method that has been used after that is called attribution patching, which was introduced more or less at the same time as ours, but got a lot more traction. And the idea is quite similar. It's just instead of having the contrastive outputs, they contrast inputs. So they change. They have two settings. They get gradients for the two settings, kind of like in causal mediation, and then they just take the difference between the gradients. But the idea is pretty similar, kind of complementary, let's say. So now I want to move to the other work that you've seen in the readings that was related to attributing context with language models. So our original contribution in this area was this PCOR framework. So the main driver for that was that we found that attribution methods are expensive if you apply them to the whole generation, right? We've seen already, if you had to build the table that I've seen and that I've shown before for a very long generation, that would be super expensive. So you kind of want to narrow down exactly at which steps you are interested in doing attribution. And secondly, the fact of ambiguity with large vocabularies. So the second drive is this contrastive need for contrastive explanations, right? So what we propose is this plausibility evaluation of context reliance framework. And the way that this works is simply in two steps. The first step is to identify in the generation which steps are more influenced by context, and then to focus on those to do this contrastive attribution back to the context. So the final outcome of all of this is simply a pair of influential context tokens relating to some influenced generated tokens, right? So now I'll give you a very quick overview of how this works. So let's assume our model, here it's an encoder-decoder, but it doesn't really matter. And we are considering a generation task, so English to Italian generation, in which we have a context that the model needs to use to do the task correctly. So let's say here you have, I ate the pizza, this is my context, it was quite tasty. If I have to translate, it was quite tasty in Italian, I have to know whether the tasty is masculine or feminine, right? Depending on what I said before. In this case, pizza is feminine, so it needs to be buono, for example. So this is the what we call the contextual variant of the input. Then we can have a non-contextual variant that is passed as is and would predict something different, right? So here, for example, we could go with the masculine as a default, era molto buono with a O at the end. So what our method does is actually is to take the contextual version of the output and force decode it in the non-contextual case by taking this kind of information theoretic metrics at every step of the generation. So here we enforce the same token at every step, and then we look in for which one of these tokens the distribution would be the most skewed by the absence of input context, right? So we would get a score per token that then can be discretized in some with some heuristics, for example, to get a label that is either positive or negative, just to have a yes/no kind of perspective here. So in this case, we would find this last token that was generated is the one that is the most influenced by the context, right? So yeah,
Oh, you
David,
saw me on
you
mute.
had a
Yes.
question. Yeah.
So you say force decode. So is this just so I which I didn't really understand the force decode. So you're sort of making two predictions and you're asking let me think about this for a second. So you're asking what is or I see. So you're putting the prediction y hat in, and you're using the model to evaluate that prediction,
Yeah, exactly.
and then you're making a heat map over the evaluated tokens to say which one is most unlikely. And are you doing that with KL divergence for the
Yeah,
whole distribution,
in this
or?
case, we tried several metrics, and KL divergence was the one that was leading to the best results.
I
We
see.
also
So.
tried to contrast just the probability of the top token,
I
like
see. I see.
as
I
a
see. So it's
difference,
not
yeah.
literally just the top token. It's just whatever the model was thinking there. You're taking that whole distribution, and then you're putting it in. You're saying how different is that from what the model wants to think,
Exactly, yeah.
over in this situation. But for on the input side, you have to feed in the whole sentence, and so you're just feeding in
Yeah.
the whole sentence on the input
Yeah,
side.
the two alternatives, right? The
I see.
one with the context, the one without. Yeah, I think this force decode can be a bit misleading here because the example is
Okay.
very short, right? But imagine if you had a long example that has many of these kind of keywords that were influenced by the context. The idea here is that I just wanted to express that you will always keep the two cases identical. So you're kind of like adding the whatever is that from the contextual case, regardless of what the non-contextual case would predict there, to ensure that the prefix is always matching, right?
Because the output becomes part of the input as you go autoregressively.
Exactly. And you have to match them, otherwise you would have a disagreement that might be mediated by different outputs, right?
Okay. Sorry to
Yeah.
ask this question so fast. Is it? I want to let the students ask further if we've confused them.
I don't know if this is clear enough.
So the goal of this step is to basically get a heat map over these Ys, over the output.
Yeah,
Okay,
pretty
great.
much. Yeah, so as I said, these will be continuous cores, but then we would get this kind of discrete yes no labels, right?
Sure.
So the reason why we need these yes no labels is for the step two, where these will allow us to understand where to do the attribution, right? So the key interesting thing that I think we introduce here is that let's say that we have our sequence. So this is the contextually generated output with these labels, right? The key step here is that we want to force the prefix that is the same for all the tokens that weren't found contextually sensitive, right? But then to sample from the non-contextual setting the alternative, right? So basically here, this is just a data-driven way to get these contrastive pairs that then would allow us to do contrastive attribution by exploiting the same model without the context to get what would be its prediction without the context, right? So now we kind of bootstrap this minimal pair of like words. That then can be, we can do the contrastive attribution that I showed before. So probability of one minus the other, and propagate this throughout the model back to the input contexts. So what we get here is, for example, this continuous cores at the token level, like I showed before. And this again would be discretized to get pairs. So here, the way that we would read that is, the pizza in the source is influencing Buona, and also the pizza in the target is influencing Buona, right? Is this clear enough? I know it's quite complex as a structure. Yeah, so what kind of this decision can we make off of these results? I think the interesting part that you like, the interesting idea here would be that you can apply this to any kind of task, let's say, in a bit of a blind way, right? Like you have a generation from the model. You could just entirely in a data-driven way, I run my P-core approach. I get these relations between input and outputs. And then you could explore the outputs, right? And form hypotheses, right? So we had kind of interesting examples that we found when we did that on machine translation. Sadly, I don't have them here in the slides, but one example that I can mention that surprised me was that we had a text where the model was receiving some information like the soccer match is at 10 a.m., written like 10 semicolon 00 a.m. And then it had a text that was saying something like the match was a fierce competition and it ended 26 to 0, right? For the blue team, for example. And the model was deciding to format 26 to 0 with the semicolon because the time in the context was using the same semicolon format to express the hour, right? Which is kind of a weird behavior if you think about it. I would have never thought of that myself. So I think that kind of highlights the importance of making this data driven, right? So a big motivation for us was that most of this kind of evaluation here rely on this kind of hypothesis based, I don't know, I expect my model to have a gender bias, so I craft my set of data with gender bias and I test them on that, right? Well, here you can just run it on anything and then kind of post hoc look at if there is something interesting there, right? So yeah, that's the overall idea.
That's cool. And
Yeah.
so it's sort of is a way to think about this is there's just too much information in the all pairs sort of attribution, and you're doing things to try to winnow that down to a small number of edges that you really want to pay attention to. Is that right?
Exactly. And I think, more philosophically speaking, moving forward with like interpreting, very complex scenarios, I think this kind of narrowing down what we really care for will be super important in the future too. You know, even if we want to do, I don't know, mechanistic analysis of, you know, something sketchy is going on here that we didn't expect, you know. I think in reasoning or like agents, you know, I think this will become more and more important to kind of narrow down what's going on there. So yeah. So that was the original idea here. So and the next reasonable step here was, wait, now we can connect outputs to
Oh,
inputs.
did Jasmine get to ask her question? I see another text that flew by. Did you get to ask your question, Jasmine?
Yeah. I
You're
kind
all
of
set.
took
Okay,
it up.
cool. Okay, that's great.
So the next reasonable step here was, well, now we can link outputs to inputs. Can we use that to create citations, right? So this was very relevant. It was, a couple of years ago, we didn't have, again, these models that could cite themselves well. They weren't trained to do that. So our idea was, can we just looking at the internals, understand how the inputs are influencing the generation, right? So Mirage works exactly in the same way as Pecore. So here we are, our context that gets added or removed is the three documents that were retrieved by a retrieval system and added to the prompt. And the functioning is exactly the same. We would see how these three documents shift the probability distribution of the model for specific tokens in the answer, and then trace this back to some specific tokens in one of the documents that are responsible for the shift. So I wanted to show this picture that was also in the paper that you were referred to by David. I think this is quite good evidence in relation to what Nikhil was asking before, that even though it's not super clean, this is entirely gradient based, so this is raw gradients for attribution, and you can see that here on the x-axis you have the five documents that were given as context, and every point here is a word within a document that receives an attribution score, right? So the y-axis is kind of like the attribution intensity for that word, given the output here, 9 in the generation, right? So you can see that this quite cleanly points at the exact match, 19 billion in the document one, as a motivation for predicting 19 billion in the answer. So even though it's not super clean, there is still like enough information to kind of, you know, cut out exactly what we want here. In the paper we try different approaches, and we were using some heuristic, like let's take the top 5% or the top 20% of these tokens based on their attribution scores. But we also tried calibration, so kind of like trying to select what would be a good threshold to match a set of gold labels in a way that then we can just find this threshold value and then apply it, you know, to unseen documents. And that seemed to help. So in general, if you have a gold annotated data set with the citations that you want, that probably would be a good way to select these thresholds. There were some questions related to Mirage. Maybe people that are here can ask them.
I was asking what would happen if like attribution saw two documents that are similar but like different in tone. So like they
Right.
may have like the same content but presenting different viewpoints.
I thought that was a very good question. I think it depends a lot on the model, right? So it might be that the model will find that, you know, a more explicit mention of something is more actionable to come to an answer. So it might be that that receives the higher importance. Actually, what I mentioned here is that recency is probably the most common trend that you see in language models. So if something is mentioned several times, the last time the last mention is probably going to be the one that the model is mostly relying on. But this all relates to this thing that we were saying before. Attribution pertains only to the current context, right? So, like the fact that this token receive a high importance is not exactly a proxy for saying if this token wasn't there, then everything would change. Because, like in this case of redundant mentions, if these tokens disappeared, then other tokens could take the attribution other place. So sometimes this can lead to this kind of misleading interpretations, right? And
Is Arye here?
yeah, but I think you've already answered my question, so I
Yeah,
don't have to
pretty
explain again.
related. Yeah. And was this last one?
Shuyi?
Not here, I think.
Shuyi is here, but maybe not. Yeah, I'm not sure. Oh, mic
All
is not
right.
working. Okay, that's
Okay,
fine.
okay. I can just summarize. So the idea here was, is this procedure of like forcing the prefix when considering this difference from the context, actually breaking the Mirage framework, right? In a sense, because you're forcing a prefix of the output that is maybe not what the model would generate when the context was absent, right? So definitely this leads to some potentially out of distribution behavior there. But considering that that's mostly used to select cases where the context was influential, actually this can lead to some interesting things, like if something becomes explicitly mentioned in the output, then it might be that whatever comes after is now relying on the output of the model rather than relying on the context, right? So maybe at first you need to rely on the context, but from there onwards, now you're just relying on the output. So all the subsequent mentions would not be picked out, right, as context sensitive. So I think that's actually something interesting, that actually reflects how the model operates, right? All right. Let me. Yeah, and I just wanted to show you. So we have an API for PCOR inside in Seek now. So that's pretty convenient to use, and it can be used within a Jupyter notebook. It's quite nice. So we can have a look at this example together. I think it's quite informative. So here, the input that the model receives is when was the most successful player in NBA history born? And this is not a great model. It's like a 300 million parameter model. So it's pretty bad at doing language modeling. So here, the model is predicting 2015, 2016. But then it's also saying the most successful player in NBA history is Steven John something. Okay. So we set our threshold when we apply the method, and we found that John, in this case, is one of these tokens that is context sensitive, right? So if we open this toggle here, what we see is three documents that the model received that were appended to the prompt, right? So this is a RAG setup, kind of like in Mirage, right? So you can see that the tokens within these documents are colored based on how influential they were towards the prediction of John here. And we can see that the most influential ones are actually Steve and John, right? Which makes sense. So it means the third document here is what is driving the prediction of Steve and John here. But I think even more informative is the fact that here you can also see what the model would have predicted in the non-contextual case. So here the model would have said Stephen Kerr, which is probably Stephen Curry, right? I'm not a basketball expert, but I guess that will make sense. But it was kind of like, sidetracked by the presence of the Stephen John here in context or towards predicting Stephen John here. So I think this is interesting because basically this example is pointing at the fact that this model is over relying on the context versus its previous memorized information. So it probably would have said something reasonable if only using memory, but the context has such a big influence on what it's predicting that it decided to go for something that maybe is not ideal here, right? So this is the kind of visualization you can get in a notebook. So in the InSeek repository, we have a notebook with exactly this example, so to reproduce exactly this, and some analysis on reasoning also. So yeah, so it's a new version that we released some time ago. Any question on that? No. All right.
I'll be interested in how whether the whatever methods get adapted to different research projects. Each one of these methods is exposing something different, so I'll just be really curious.
That's
And
true.
I think it's fair if people are like, oh, I might use some of these methods for my research project, for people to just ask now while we have Gabriel here to sort of share his wisdom or opinions about different possible applications.
I mean, I just want to mention that my perspective on that is like, this is great, like if you have this kind of setup, right? My next question would be, well, I found that Stephen John now is influencing John, right? Let's look at the internals, right? Let's do like our circuit analysis. Let's do our, causal mediation. But now we have an anchor point. We have some behavior that we identified that is there, right? And that would have been much more painful to do had we had to do causal mediation on the full sequence of documents here, right? So I think this is great to get started on like finding interesting phenomena that then you can dig deeper with the mechanistic toolkit, right? So yeah. So
Cool.
if you intend to use these kind of things, that's probably my suggestion. And oh yeah, there were a couple of final slides here. The first was about interactions. So here the idea is, like as many of you ask about this, can we model this kind of second order effects, interactions? And indeed, there are several methods to do that. There is this Shapley interaction index, which the idea here is you try pairs of groups of features going increasing in size with these groups to understand when a group is minimal to predict some behavior. And then you have also gradient-based methods. So this Hessian or integrated Hessian are basically the equivalent of gradients, but you're taking the second order derivative. So you're taking like which other factors are more influential for the gradient of that factor to get to this magnitude, right? So in this case, yeah, it's the equivalent for interactions. The only problem with all of these methods is that they're quite expensive because you're potentially, estimating all possible interaction with all possible groups. So that could become very expensive unless you start by some, assumption of like how this group should be formed. I think some people were working at the level of syntax, for example, right? If something belongs to the same phrase, then it makes sense that they are kind of part of the same group. But yeah, I think that's the only actionable way to study these kind of things. And the final thing, I really like this question from Jasmine that was like why are we even doing attribution? Like what's the final goal, right? What's the end game of attribution? So I think it's a good way to kind of close on that. And I just wanted to highlight some of the works that use that. I think one of the very convincing use cases was from people that do protein design. I thought this was from a presentation at iClear 2 years ago. I found it very interesting because there were these people from Genentech that do this kind of lab protein design, kind of like lab in the loop protein design. And when they were giving their keynote, I was pretty surprised to find out that They were saying, yeah, if we were to identify exactly which amino acids are responsible for like a specific gene expression, that would be very painful to do, like by trying out all possible things. So we just do gradient-based attribution on that, on the protein sequence, and we use that, right? So I found it quite compelling as an idea. So there are some interesting direction here. And I feel like now people are starting to use these kind of methods also for other more actionable purposes. So here, there is a recent paper that we're trying to use attribution to lead to steer generation towards looking at specific regions of interest. So like if you define a constraint in the prompt, you could decide which tokens to pick based on which tokens are relying the most on that part of the prompt where you're defining your constraint. Yeah, it's interesting. I would have some criticism about this probably, but I think it's potentially promising. And finally, one thing that I wanted to highlight specifically because it feels like in the mechanistic community, people think, oh, attribution is a thing for the past, and now we don't do this anymore. We did that on images, in the 2010s. But actually, all the new methods that do circuit finding. So I think you have a class, David, in the upcoming weeks about that, right? But all these kind of methods that aim to find, how components interact towards a prediction are using effectively some form of attribution, right? Most of them now are gradient-based, actually, some form of integrated gradients or, so I think these questions are still, very, very recent and very important. It's just maybe they kind of became so consolidated that now they moved away from the spotlight kind of, and now they're just the kind of tools that we use without even thinking about it, which is great, I guess. Yeah.
They're still salient.
Exactly. Still important to know what's salient. Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah. So I think that's it for me. Thank you so much for having me. And if you have any questions, I'm here to answer, of course.
Thanks, Gabriel. It's really, really, really helpful.
Great. I'm glad.
Yay. Everybody liked it.
So.
So yeah, so it's actually so what you know it's you will sort of keep up with the theme of what we're doing. I encourage everybody to give a try to these input attribution methods. There's as you can see, there's a lot. Yes, I agree with what Jasmine says. It feels particularly broadly useful in situations with high stakes decisions. My intuition is a lot of these interdisciplinary questions that you guys are asking, where you have a lot of organic text and you're asking how is the model thinking during processing of complex text, I feel like these methods are really well suited for it, which is why I wanted to make sure we cover it before spring break. And so I think it'll be great. I'll be interested to see if you're able to find anything interesting in your projects using these methods. And we have Gabriel here this semester,
Right.
so take advantage of him. He's directly helping out one of the teams, but he's a general resource for the class.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll also share the links, of course, to this library that we built in the Discord channel so that you can have a look.
Great. Okay, guys. Stay safe in the snow out there,
Yeah.
and we'll see you. I'm not sure we'll see you in person on Thursday or not. Hopefully the weather will cooperate, and we'll see you in person on Thursday.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Yeah.